Blog Talk Radio.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane!
No, it's Max, Darryl, and D-Bert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
It's 2:10:13, folks. Welcome to the Comic Shop. Hey, it's the Grindhouse Edition of Comic Shop, the pre-Grammy show. Last week was the pre-Super Bowl show. And to be more exact, this is the pre-Grammy show. Folks, give us a buzz, 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. Let's go to a quick nerdcore groove, and then we'll get back with more pulp and pop-flavored discourse. I hope I have the pronunciation correct. I've said this term for many years in the incorrect way. I found out the correct way, I think, from the Thor movie. I think it's Mjolnir. Is it Mjolnir? I used to say Mjolnir. I think half of the comic world said Mjolnir. I think it's Mjolnir, I think. Thor's hammer. Anyway, that's the title of this new nerdcore cut by Adam Warlock, Mjolnir, I think. We'll be back, folks. Let's groove a little. Mjolnir.
Yeah. You hear that thunder coming? Yeah.
Mystery, silver age, when I drop on the beat like a hammer to a nail, I crack the concrete, when I fell from the sky and my feet hit the street, a Norse god, and y'all can call me Odin's son, from Asgard, there for Earth when the war is on, don't mistake me for a simple man, that walking stick turns to thunder in my hand, lightning bolts drop it quick, and I beat the wrecker, and I crack destroyer's armor, better watch your back cause I'm quick as wind on the rainbow bridge when I'm riding. On his shoulder, illusions and mischief. And my homeboy Hercules, he got my back when I'm in the district. And I get my power from the gods in the plains. And I hold that power in my hand. And yes, you know in the name. What? I hold me on your, that's the hammer I swing. Yo, I hold me on your when I'm doing my thing. Yeah, I am a god. I am a man. I am a legend. I am a superhero. Protecting Earth and avenging with me on your, that's the hammer. Med school, can't handle blood and guts, call me Donald Blake with a JD, you know what's up, when I hold the mic I transform into a thing unknown, I went toe to toe with the Hulk and now he's going home, and I drop on the dot, got it out of the rock and the skies they open wide, so coming against me better have a hole on the inside, or ultimate nullify, cause Reed Richards and the Fantastic Four even stopped to take pictures, Asgard, where the gods and dark elves dwell, where they guard the pathways to heaven and the pathways to hell, and the thunder and lightning announce my victory, with tooth gnasher and tooth grinder I'm cruising down the street, it's only me, Cap and Beta Ray.
All right, folks, once again, I think I'm pronouncing it correct, Mjolnir by Adam Warlock, a person we have to get on the show. Undoubtedly, we have to get him on the show because we play all of his music, and plus, I think it's worthy of discussion as to how he's so expertly able to put his lyrical content, intersperse his lyrical content with comic book lore. So, again, Adam Warrock. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. And I could not do the show, not with any kind of effectiveness, efficacy, without my crew. First up, beaming down, Captain Kirk. Captain, it's your time.
Forget the JLA. After Superman, let's go into Shazam. Stop it.
Oh, God. And then, of course, Daryl B.
Who the hell is Shazam? I want a Captain Marvel movie.
Yeah, that's another issue. for many years, people had said, Daryl, you have to admit it, said, well, why don't they just call him Shazam? But so much time has passed that everyone knows that Captain Marvel is Captain Marvel. I'm used to knowing who Captain Marvel is. Now they decided to say, well, we're just going to call him Shazam. They should have done that 40 years ago. We know who Captain Marvel is now. Oh, whatever.
Too late. Again, it's out of the barn.
Again, the Comic Shop, Grindhouse Show, 6 p.m., the Comic Shop, 7 p.m., Afternoon featuring Captain Kirk. Actually, we're expecting our friend, David Walker from Dark Horse Comics and number 13. I wanted him to stop by because we're going to talk about comic book writers, or rather the dearth of comic book writers, especially at the big two, Marvel and DC. So what better person to speak about the subject than to have an actual comic book writer beam on in and school us as to what's going on? I think we have theories, Daryl, but perhaps someone who's actually in the business can really give us a clue as to what the hell is going on. So hopefully he'll come through momentarily. Quickly, you know, since the captain brought up this Justice League business, what's going on here, man? We have this gentleman, Will Beale, who was attached to the Justice League as being a writer. He's already off the Justice League because he wrote Gangster Squad, and Gangster Squad flopped with Sean Penn. And I think, who else is in there as well? You had top flight actors in Gangster Squad.
Yeah, you had Mackie, who was going to portray Falcon in the Captain America movie. You had Ryan Gosling in it. You had, I mean, the cast was top-notch. Maybe it's a sign that people are sick of the same old tropes. You know, I've said it before. Hey, I don't need every black person on the street to be a drug dealer, you know, all that. I don't need us going back and constantly doing gangster films. I'm sorry, they're not appealing. Maybe that thing has reached its saturation point. You never know, because I didn't think it was that bad. Was it Oscar-worthy? No, but if you want to shoot them up with gangsters and stuff, it fit right there. Maybe it's a sign of things to come.
Yeah, I think so, Daryl. I think the problem, listen, I wanted to like it, but it just looks like something we've seen before. It looks so much like a retread, like an afterthought. I don't know. You just can't put pretty people and stuff, so, and I'm saying in quotes, pretty people and vehicles, and then expect it to work. I thought it had a lot going in with name value, but it didn't have an Argo feel to it. Now, you know, listen, Argo is a different thing. But you know, but still, you know, if you have Sean Penn in a movie, Gosling, I think people are looking at it like, wait a minute, Mackie included. These guys have done some pretty stellar work. So, you know, I don't know, man. It just looked like it was straight to Netflix.
Well, so, you know what it was? It was the gods paying back all those DC fans that when Ben Affleck got attached to the or was rumored to be attached, they, oh no, oh. We can't have Ben Affleck. No, we don't want that. Okay, and then they chose this writer, and the DC fans were like, oh, okay, this is better. You know, he's doing Gangster Squad. That doesn't look bad. Argo, want to see plenty of them at the Oscars. Gangster Squad is going to fade into obscurity or become a constant on cable movie network TV. Good job, DC and your fans.
Well, you know, another thing, too, is that, you know, now we're hearing, you know, you never know what's real and what's fallacy. But we're hearing now that if Ben Affleck were to have gotten the Justice League, that he was also expected to be Batman also, which is ironic because he was Daredevil, and Batman and Daredevil are kind of sort of the same character. Some folks have likened Daredevil to being a blue-collar version of Batman. So, you know, I think there would have been too much stink in that costume from what he wore, the Daredevil costume. I don't know if he would have been a great fit for Batman. I think there would have been a revolt.
It sounds too much like damage control. It sounds like rewriting the facts. The instant Ben Affleck's name was attached to this, you know, people got outraged. But Argo did so well that now Warner Brothers and DC got to make themselves look good. Oh, we couldn't have Ben Affleck and he was going to be Batman. You remember, the winners always rewrite history to suit them. So, hey, Ben Affleck hasn't said a word about it. Why? He knows that, hey, I got Argo. I got this. I don't need to worry about them anymore. Simply put.
Captain, what are your thoughts on this deal with Mr. Beale losing out, and now there's talk that this thing might be crumbling?
That's my thought. That's supposed to be my thought, man. That's what it is. That's what it is, Apple Nerd. That's my thought right there.
Well, you know, it looks like I think I see someone out the front door. I think so. Mr. Walker? I'm giving a pre-applause. Dave.
Uh-oh.
219?
Oh, hey, guys. It's Chad, not Dave.
Okay. Well, you know, you're deserving of applause anyway. Chad, welcome to Comic Shop. Let me give
a
quick.
Take it. That might be the only applause I get all week. I'll take it.
Oh dear God.
So I'm going to send a quick buzz to Mr. Walker. But since you've come in, what are your thoughts about this Justice League deal where Mr. Beale lost the gig? Undoubtedly, you know, Hollywood is a pretty cruel place. His Gangster Squad really didn't do much, so I suspect that's the reason why he lost out on the gig. So what are your thoughts about this Justice League perhaps crumbling, that it's not – the House of Cards may fall on this thing. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of pressure on the Justice League movie because of the success of the Avengers, because of the success – of the moderate success of the X-Men franchise. And, you know, I think that DC and the movie studios back in the movie want, you know, they almost want something that's guaranteed to be a big hit, and that's got, you know, that's not just a good script with good actors and everything and so on. I think it's a shame that Paul Dini's not going to be writing it, because I think he would be between him and Bruce Timm, I think they would do an excellent job with the movie, but for whatever reason, they don't want to be tied to it.
Would you want to be tied to it right now, the way the man has handled this?
You know, I think it's doomed to fail. I don't think they're going to be able to pull it off. I think it's going to be in production hell for a real long time. I think Marvel, just real short, I mean to interrupt, I think Marvel has done such a good job of, you know, these precursor movies. You know, they did Captain America and Iron Man and Hulk and Thor and then the Avengers, that DC, you know, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. They almost do need to do a Batman, a Superman, a Green Lantern, a Flash, and then do the Justice League. But then if they don't do that, people are going to say they should have done it. If they do it, people are going to say they copied Marvel. So I think they're in a very, very precarious spot right now.
But just think about this, right? We all know Paul Dini from interviews and from seeing him at conventions and everything. This is a dude that will do anything comic related as long as he feels a passion for it. We know he has a passion for DC heroes, yet in his latest interview, he said, "I ain't touching DC live action with a 10-foot pole." If you got one of the biggest geeks, one of the most passionate men in the business saying, "I ain't touching the JLA franchise with a 10-foot pole," what does that say?
Yeah, you know,
DC
I think,
and Warner Brothers has killed us. They're on a mission to kill everything we love. That, I'm convinced of that now.
I think it, one of the reasons why, and I'm speaking for him, but I think one of the reasons why, you know, a guy like Paul Dini or a guy like the late Dwayne McDuffie wouldn't have done something like that is if they didn't feel that they had enough creative carte blanche to do it and to do it right. And DC's going to want to try and, you know, they got to make so many people happy. They got to make the true comic book nerds happy. They got to make the newcomers happy. They got to make the dramatic film goer happy. And they may start trying to cut corners on the comic book nerds and the geeks to try and, you know, create this totally different universe than what, you know, some of the great writers that we love from the comic books and the cartoons, the animated series and so on, what they would have produced. And maybe they're like, hey, you know what, we're going to let this thing crash on its own.
Well, listen, I spoke to Daryl about this. I might have mentioned this on air. I already thought of what I thought would be a great introduction into the Justice League from the Man of Steel. Without having to copy the Marvel method of doing it. I thought that, well, first of all, I don't know how this Man of Steel is going to come out this summer and there not being a connection to some kind of outside. You just can't keep on making these standalone films without any connection to more heroes. That's what's going to be problematic. So Man of Steel, I would really be shocked if we look at this film and it ends up being a standalone film. That's one thing. It could be an easy thing, an easy reference to even stock footage from Batman Begins with some nut in Gotham causing wreck. And towards the tail end of the Man of Steel, it's implied that the Man of Steel is going to have to deal with this guy. You let there be a World's Finest movie as the second installment, and then World's Finest goes right to a Justice League. That way, there's no comparisons with Marvel, and there's no need for all these setups. That's all you have to do. But for some reason, they don't want to take Afro Nerd's advice. So it is.
Yeah, your one problem with that is who's Batman? Christian Bale said, "I don't want to be in the role anymore." Who's your Batman? You had a perfect setup with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He didn't need to be Batman.
No, no, no,
fans
no.
Fans hated on that.
No,
I didn't say that he had to be Batman. He could have been Nightwing. He could have been.
This is what you do. What they try to do for Superman, the last Superman, would actually work for Batman. There's like a 25-year gap between the last movies with Christopher Reeve and them trying to have Brandon Routh trying to pretend to be Christopher Reeve. But literally that film, Superman Returns, was intent on being Superman 3, essentially. It was essentially, we are led to believe that was supposed to be the sequel to that film. They should have never have done that. But since the Batman films are more recent, I could believe that they should just go ahead and have another actor, another tight actor, not Christian Bale, but someone who's that the acting world and the geek world respects to essentially take on that universe, to be where that universe was. That's what I would do without it being Bale. You're going to have to make some kind of connection to that world, to Nolan, to the Nolanverse, and move on from there in World's Finest. That's what I would do.
Guillermo del Toro, please save this franchise. Please. I know you're doing Justice League Dark or Shadow Pact or whatever we're going to call it, but please just move over, take over Justice League, because as it is now, we're going to get the Batman Beyond movie before we get the JLA movie.
Well, that might not be bad either. Well, actually, let's go. Speaking, since Chad brought up Paul Dini, this was quite vocal in a recent tweet, and someone asked him about this. Someone said, "Paul, I'm asking you as a friend, please write the Justice League movie. I'm begging you." And he says, "Sorry, went that route with Batman Beyond. Ick. If I write a superhero flick, it's with my own character. Less expectation, more fun." So he doesn't want to do it unless they play coy, because sometimes in this world, you can't act like you really want something, because that way they will beg you, and then they have to give you more money.
if they're playing coy, they've been playing coy for like 25 years.
No, I don't know about that. I don't know that's fair. I don't think there's this whole thing, you know, there's this whole thing with Warner Brothers. They like to have bad embargoes, everything separate, the animated world separate from the live action world. It looks like they never even asked this guy. We heard only within the last, what, year or two that there's more talk of maybe going that route and getting some of the talent from animation. Well, we only started hearing that within last year. Last year is when I actually heard people talking about the obvious, because they went through so much failure that they said, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should speak to these guys. It's been a long time coming. They weren't asked 20 years ago to do live.
Yeah, but I look at it this way, right? Okay, in your house, this is who you had write Superman, all right? And write Avengers, write Superman and write JLA, okay? You've had Jeff Johns. You've had Kurt Busiek. You've had Mark Waid. You've had Grant Morrison, a dog, all seeing God of Comics, Grant Morrison. You've had him. You've had Paul Dini write it. You had all this talent, Kevin Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis. You've had all of these guys underneath your thumb, John Byrne. You've had all of these guys. These are heavy hitters, Peter David. You've had all of these heavy hitters in there. You can't get them into a room to at least shout out theories and stuff with some of these incoming writers. Go like, yo, I know you officially don't work for us anymore, or I know you don't want to take a major capacity on the book, but here's this writer. He's trying to do a JLA script. Yo, can you oversee the process? Can you help him out? You know, can you do that? You know what? I hate the Mark Millar move with Fantastic Four, but you know what? In retrospect, that's a good thing, because you have Mark Millar there who has a little history with the characters, with the writers on the book, and he can help steer it. Now, I'm saying all of this, and we know that Jeff Johns has said that Green Lantern is the best comic book movie he's ever been a part of, and, you know, I have to doubt the decision-making, but at least have somebody in there with a writer. And Captain's laughing again. Here you go.
Can I say something? Can I say something? You know what actually is happening here? And it's real simple. Pressure. If there wasn't that type of pressure, if the Avengers did not do as good as it did, let's just say Avengers was a really good movie, just as it was, we all admit Avengers is really good, and it didn't do those big numbers that it did. The writing might be, just a suggestion, be better for the JLA situation, because the pressure is not there. You start, these individuals start writing, and then people turn around and say, look, it has to be done in a certain amount of time. We have to be able to put it together, because we have the Avengers coming, we have this coming, we have all of this pressure. It's pressure. And sometimes pressure is very good because it drives competition. But sometimes people just don't handle the pressure very well. That's why I'm laughing. That's why I've been laughing. They do really good when they stand alone, at least as far as Batman is concerned. We'll see what Superman is going to do. And I think Superman will do well. And then after Superman does well, then they'll be able to get back to the drawing board, because pressure is off. If, just say, for some crazy reason, and I don't think this will be the case, Superman flops.
Oh, God.
I don't think it's going to be the case. I do not think it's going to be the case. But let's just say if it did, what do you think would be going on over there? They'd be cleaning house over there. It'd be like chickens without a head. You ever see a chicken run around without a head? They're losing their mind. When you come with Iron Man and it does well and everything else comes, oh, come on, man. Come on. So it's pressure right now. That's all. That's why I'm laughing.
One quick thing. I want to go to a quick groove. But before that, a couple of things, just food for thought. One, Mark Miller came out recently and said, hey, the Avengers was your Justice League. He said, you're going to have to deal with the Avengers being the JLA. He said, Thor was Superman. I think he said, he mentioned a couple other characters that he said, oh, yeah, Iron Man was Bruce Wayne. If you take some of their, he said, Lex Luthor was Loki. So he said that's what it was. you're going to have to accept the Avengers were the Justice League. I mean, he was rather flippant about it. But when you think about it, they are kind of analogs for what the JLA is ultimately going to be, or could have, what it could be if they actually make a movie. And but they're not going to be able to do this. And what's even messed up is it took time for Marvel to be the cohesive unit that it is. Marvel was in far more disarray, you know, as far as on a corporate level, than what Warner Brothers is. Warner Brothers has always been one unit. There's less excuse for Warner Brothers to be able to produce a film because everything is in-house. There's no such thing as everything having been fielded out. Marvel has had more excuses, really, for failure, considering that they sold many of the rights to their characters to other studios. That never happened with Warner Brothers. So it makes you wonder what the hell's going on.
I don't know.
Hire our crew. There'll be no mistakes.
Wait, Chad, Cap, Afro, you don't know how much I'm praying right now that Josh Whedon has Thanos underlings in Avengers 2 be Squadron Supreme or Squadron Sinister. You have no idea how much. If I get the evil Nighthawk, the evil Hyperion, the evil Dr. Spectrum, you know, and throw in one or two of the other analogs as his henchmen to take on the Avengers, and then look at DC, we still have JLA in the planning stages. You don't know how much I'm going to geek out and go, oh, DC, oh, I feel sorry. Oh, Warner Brothers, I'm so sorry for you.
Thanos is Darkseid. Thanos is Darkseid. Nothing. That may be what it is. That may be what it boils down to. All right, folks, let's go to a quick groove. This is the Spider-Man theme as done by Michael Bublé. Let's groove. We'll be back in a few moments.
Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there, here goes a Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrived just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Wealth and fame he's ignored, action is his reward. Look out, there goes the Spider-Man. Watch out, Miss Spider-Man. A streak of light, he arrived just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Wealth and fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward. To him, life is a great big hang up. Wherever there's a playing up, you find the Spider-Man.
understand the great Michael Bublé doing the Spider-Man theme. Kind of dig that tune, kind of a jazzed up version of the 67 cartoon Filmation. But I know it was in 67 that the Spider-Man cartoon came out. All right, folks, again, it's the Comic Shop, and afternoon featuring Captain Kirk at 7. The call-in number is 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. We have Chad, we have Captain Kirk, we have Daryl B., the full house. Dave Walker, I don't know what happened to you, but he's a friend of the show nevertheless. I assume something probably came up, so we'll have him back again. I wanted him to come through because doing a quick transition, gentlemen, I want to talk about this article that Robot 6 came out. I think Daryl brought it to my attention. But I remember seeing it before. I thought it was a pretty interesting piece. And essentially it's from Robot 6 from the comicbookresources.com blog. And it's talking about the dearth of black writers in the two major camps, Marvel and DC. And what is that all about? So, Daryl, you brought this to my attention. This is why I wanted Dave Walker. David Walker is an African-American comic book writer, but he works for Dark Horse. And they have a number of these other outfits. They have black writers. Why not Marvel and DC? What's going on here?
All right. Firstly, the original article was from Comics Alliance with their chief editor, Joseph Hughes. And he talked about the lack of diversity with the big two. The Robot 6 article I found interesting because it was a white writer, a white suburban writer, talking about because one of his favorite books was New Warriors and Night Thrasher. And he never realized that Fabian Nzenza wasn't black as how he was writing it until he got to be older. So he was talking about writing about the black experience and all that, used quotes from Nzenza and stuff like that with it. And, you know, early on, we've often talked that we'd love to get black writers to get a chance. That's why I'm rooting so hard for number 13, so that Walker and Love, they get noticed and be put on higher profile books. Even though, hey, Dark Horse, if you keep them on number 13 for a long time, I'll be happy because I've been very happy with the book. But a couple things occurred to me. One, all right, and the comic section in Comics Alliance was real good because I got a variety of comments and ideas. Let's face it, in the inner circles of comics, the only guy we had in there was McDuffie. When McDuffie passed away, our in is out, if you catch the drift. Our main guy who would vouch for some of these black writers is out. So you're going to have to work harder. But my thing is, I'm not seeing the black writers getting really that much of a chance, you know. They're not in those inner circles. They're not. And when I look at conventions and everything, you know, I see a lot of great black artists. But the great black writer, you know, that's it, the problem's going both ways here, all right? They're not getting chances, sure, but where are they? You have to look hard to find them. Dark Horse, Boom, you could go to those companies, you'll find them. But, you know, I don't know if it's Marvel and DC not going out looking for them, not going out to recruit them. I don't know if they've become so disillusioned with the big two. They've essentially said, you know what, screw sending in submissions to these two. They're not going to give me a fair shake. We saw what they did with McDuffie. We saw what they did with Kevin Graveau. You know what, screw them. We don't want them. And they've decided, you know, I'm backing off. I mean, there is no simple answer here. Back to you, Afro Nerd. Uh-oh. Hello?
I'm here. I had my mic off again. Sorry about this, folks. Let me back up what I said. What I was saying is that we're in a quandary, and we have always been to a certain degree. You know, we had Reginald Hudlin on Black Panther, but he's a busy guy. He's busy producing major films. But then again, a lot of these other guys seem to be able to do TV, do film, and still do comic books. So I don't know why it might be, you know, any difficulty with Hudlin. Hudlin would have been a good example of that. Christopher Priest helped put Black Panther on the map, really. Actually, the trajectory that Black Panther is in comic books now, the DNA, the bones of it, goes back all the way, really, to Christopher Priest's work. So was he just railroaded out of the industry? I mean, what happened to the people that were there? Like, Christopher Priest, I mean, he's the one that really did it for the Black Panther. What happened to him? What's his story?
As far
as I
know,
him also.
Yeah, as far as I know, he's been one of those guys that's been disillusioned. He went, screw him. I've been on long enough. I'm not going back. You know? I don't know. Cap may have more information. Chad may have more information about it. But the feeling I get from a lot of the responses from minority writers, not just black writers, but minority writers is, you know, if you're the hot new thing, oh, they love you. But, you know, there comes a time where either jealousy or business practices make you want to give them up. And I use it as proof again. Look at what they promised McDuffie when they gave him JLA. And look how badly that went. He got Milestone back into the DC Universe. He did all of that. But look at how they meddled with his run. So it wasn't a definitive run with him as to, like, how he did on Justice League Unlimited. He was able to pull different writers and stuff like that, get them to work together and form cohesive plots going on. He was never able to do that when he worked on JLA because of the editorial interference. You know,
well,
is it that we can't write in the rules? Is it that the event thing killed us off? Don't know.
Well, first of all, to our listening audience, I'm going to put a link on AfroNerd.com. I would implore you to go visit AfroNerd.com anyway. But there's a link I'm going to put up there within, I guess, an hour or so after our last broadcast today. There's a link to this documentary that we referenced before about the whole deal with black superheroes, black creators. And actually, McDuffie makes a final appearance. And he's all over this thing. And you're right. McDuffie really was the point man. And when we lost him, I knew. We were fortunate enough to have interviewed him. And he was very, very cordial, you know, very straight-up guy. And he told you, I didn't really understand, you know, he explained the business aspect of it. I didn't understand why Static Shock was no more. And essentially, it had a lot to do with this. It's always about money, but it was on for 4 years. I'm thinking, well, maybe it's a ratings thing. He said, no, it was highly rated. It wasn't about race, about the ability to sell product. It was commerce. It was ability to sell toys. And that's what's happening with our beloved Young Justice and Green Lantern animated. They can't sell toy lines from this stuff, so there it's got to go. So I think, in the documentary, they talk about early on when they had black-themed books. Forget about just black writers, but black-themed books, the comic book retailers would send them back. They couldn't move them. And it goes to women-themed books. Anything that the fanboy base, which is essentially white, if they can't understand it, they want their heroes to be white. I think that's part of the problem. But I also think there's a portion of that community that if the writing is good, if the artwork is stellar, they can't not deny it. And I've seen some of the books, whether it's Mr. Terrific, whether it's Static Shock, which they brought back, we got to be honest, they brought them back, but the look of the books looks shoddy. That is, I mean, I picked them up. I said, what is this? That's part of the problem. Chad, go on. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to jump in real quick. What Daryl just said, it strikes me very personally because I'm a writer and I'm black. And I could not agree with what he has said anymore. I can't get enough passion to agree with what he has said. He hit it dead on the head. I mean, when he said, you know, it's a very vicious circle. The companies at some point didn't take enough shots or take enough risks with black minority, whatever you want to call writers who are not your traditional white male writers. And that got down to those writers of various, you know, ethnic and minority backgrounds. So on one side, you got the companies aren't looking for them. You know, they're not going to the schools. They're not going to the places where these writers are from. And those writers have given up on trying to apply or to become part of the big two. So you got this really horrendous circle of one side's not looking, the other side's not looking to be found.
Well, you know, I want to ask a question. I remember McDuffie's run on JLA, and of course you know how he works. It was definitely a multiracial women and men. I mean, he really did it the right way. Was there a problem on the fan side, or was it internal? Was it selling well? I mean, I always thought at some point he was just abruptly taken off, and it was very controversial that he had his run. He had his run.
Yeah.
Hold on, Daryl. He had his run, and then you know you saw what he was doing. He had women, men, blacks, whites, Asians. Everybody was in full effect on that line. And when he left, that type of look left with him. So what happened? Was it a poor selling thing, or what was it?
He got Spidey clone sagaed. And let me explain this to folks. The clone saga in Spider-Man, the original clone saga, I'm not talking about the ultimate version, was only supposed to be like 18 months. Only supposed to be like 18 months. Where it would be a follow through, you know, where is Peter the real? Is Peter the clone? That sort of thing for 18 months, and then it would go back to the status quo. It brought in a lot of money. So then editors wanted to extend it and extend it and extend it. And the original creators were like, hey, the story wasn't supposed to go on this long. I don't know where to go from here. Why I say that? Okay, we go to McDuffie. And it wasn't a question of length, but they promised McDuffie, you could tell your story. You're going to get a milestone back into the DC universe. We're going to do all that. They promised him that. So he's writing his JLA, and it started to look like a combination of the animated series and Milestone. All right, and he was looking to do that. But then you had Blackest Night, and then you had Salvation Run, and then you had Infinite Crisis. Or excuse me, I got those reversed. You had Infinite Crisis for Salvation Run. You had all of these elements outside, helmed by Grant Morrison, and they tried to cater everything to Grant Morrison and Geoff Johns runs and other books and stuff. And McDuffie turned around like, wait, this was not the deal. I'm telling my story. I can make allusions to what's going on there, but you're not going to make me edit out my story to fit theirs. Editorial won, and McDuffie became a writer in the book on name only. You know, and editorial tailored the book to fit the other storylines to the point where McDuffie said, you know what, I'm off. I'm gone. You know, this ain't my story. Ironically, the same thing happened to Static Shock when it was just re-released as part of the DC New 52. They had, I think the writer's name is John Rosam, who just got off the critically acclaimed zombie book, all right? He's on there. He's our original member of Milestone, okay? So he knows Static better than most people out there. So he was going to write the book. And DC goes, no, you know what? We'll have Scott McDaniel write it, co-write it with you. He's like, wait, he doesn't know the character. He never watched the cartoon. He never read the old novel. No, but Scott McDaniel is, you know, he's a hot artist. People like his art. So he's going to help you with the plot. Wait, I'm the writer. He's the artist. No, that's it. And eventually, Rosam left the book, and he famously wrote up a big long thing about how, hey, how are you going to tell me to write a character that I have infinite knowledge in? As a result, Static Shock went down the tubes in like, what, 8 issues? You know, it's the editorial mucking of the fact that happened to McDuffie on JLA. It's the editorial mucking of the fact that's scaring a lot of black writers. And hell, it's the editorial mucking of the big two that, you know, where writers are like, you know what, we're not interested in writing for y'all. And that's a shame.
Well, one quick thing, Daryl, and I open this up to everyone. You know, they were going to do to Gail Simone, who was a white female writer. Well, we're still dealing with another minority group, or if you want to use another protected class, women. And we've seen women are getting similar treatment somewhat. But who was she? Was she on Wonder Woman? They try to take off of that. What was?
Well, she was on Batgirl, and
your Batgirl, right? Batgirl. I'm sorry.
And they canned her, and.
But there was feedback on that, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. One of the instances where social media made DC change their minds quick. Once they said that we'll let her go. Why are you letting her go? Her fan base spoke up loud, and her fan base spoke up voraciously. And 2 weeks later, they rehired her. Now that's a good and a bad thing, because if you were going to let her go here, and the pressure from the fans forced you to stay, then I guess you're stuck with her for the duration. So if her quality really dips, how could you ever let it go? You know, that's the catch 22 in all of it. But the fans spoke up and were heard. You know, where are the fans in this case? Yo,
what was the book that one of my favorite books that she was on, not Suicide Squad, what was the other one that they got rid of for some reason?
Secret Six.
Oh, my God. Secret Six was excellent. You know, and I believe it was selling quite well. But my confusion is a lot of these books actually sell, and people are let go. So one thing I have to ask, and we're going to go to another transition. What does the Black fanboy fan base have to do with this? Because it appears to me, after having gone to so many comic book shops over the years, that I see a lot of Black people purchasing comic books. It's not as if there isn't a sizable Black patronage with these books. So, you know, but it does seem like that the Black fanboy fan base is somewhat disenfranchised, or we're not really connecting. You know, we buy these books. I see plenty. I mean, I know you go to a lot of comic book stores, like I do, Daryl. Half the patronage, maybe because we're in an urban setting. I can't speak for the Midwest, but I can say in an urban setting, at least half of the patronage are Black and Latino. And yet, when things go down with Black writers or the need for Black representation in comic books, they're silent. Isn't that part of the problem as well?
Yeah. Hey, we're silent, and you know what? The companies love our money, but they don't want our voices.
We don't speak up, though.
It's a combination.
It seems like we're a bit passive. I mean, I'm a little frustrated with the creator of BlackSuperhero.com. BlackSuperhero.com was an excellent greeting place. It could have been an excellent portal for Black comic book fans, enthusiasts, writers, and now, for whatever reason, he didn't really want to monetize it. Okay, I can understand. I really can't understand. But for whatever reason, he didn't want to monetize it. I guess it would have taken up too much time. But now he shut down his forum where all these folks would congregate and discuss these issues. And for whatever reason, he shut it down. I mean, you know, you really can't. You can still visit it, but maybe because of time constraints, I guess he found maybe it's just too overwhelming for him to deal with. But a place like that is needed. You know, we have to learn how to coalesce our power for action, whether it's for writers, whether it's for a subject matter, whether it's for characters. I see too much Black money and Black representation patronizing, but they're not speaking up when this stuff goes down. Whereas we saw with Gail Simone, they weren't going to have it.
Hey, like
matter
I
fact,
said,
the whole woman thought was the womanthology thing. That was, you know, they're women, especially white women, are far more political on some things. You know, they took cues from the, and this is almost an Afro nerd discussion, but they took cues from the Black movement, from civil rights movement, just as gays have done. Yeah, you're even seeing gay representation in comic books, maybe to a better degree than Black representation. What's that about?
Hey,
they're willing to kowtow, and I'm not hating on that. But they're more willing to kowtow to that demographic than they are to the black demographic. What's up with that?
Just think about it. Young Avengers gets re-released. What were the major moves in Young Avengers? Yo, we got rid of the black Captain America wannabe. We're adding a Hispanic woman. And we're adding a child white guy onto the team. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That's great. That's beautiful.
So we're not speaking up. Black Panther, should they've done so much stuff with that. You know, it's and now he's actually good in New Avengers. As far as a solo book, I don't know what it is. They can't seem to do him right in a solo book. But when it comes down to his work with the New Avengers and his work in Fantastic Four, they seem to get him right. But moving him into a solo thing, they can't do it right. They don't want to get Christopher Priest.
Well, I just want to throw out, and this is, I'm probably going to sound like a giant, you know, conspiracy theorist or something here, but I do believe that, and I'm not saying all of the business, the business heads, the business management of the big two or any of the large companies out there are guilty of this, but I do believe that there is a glass ceiling for protected groups, minorities, women, you know, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and so on, that the characters have to be tremendously so successful that they cannot ignore bowing down or going along with the writer's desires. Because let's face it, I mean, if you look at any of the old books, any of the old black books, you know, from like, I know the 70s were the 70s, but even the 80s and so on, it was hard for black characters to not be some jive-talking, you know, street-fighting, C-level superhero. So it's like, in a sense, they can never be, you know, the intergalactic or world-saving or so on character. Or if they are, it's not for very long. And I think, like you guys mentioned, Black Panther is a great example. In his book, they started him off, he was like the Black Iron Man. He was like a genius, and then he lost his powers, and his sister came in. Eventually, his book just got scrapped. Take a look at Deathlok, which I love Deathlok from the early, I'd say mid to late 90s. Great book, started out amazing. But then eventually it descended and it lost its quality and it had to get trashed. There will never be, or I shouldn't say never, but it is very hard for us to ever get a black Superman, a black Batman, a black Iron Man, black Captain America. They're never going to allow, or they will not easily allow a character to reach that kind of status just for the sheer fact of you're not a man and you're not white. It is going to be that difficult. And as much as it might not be the right forum, it's a lot like getting a president of color. It takes not just the minority voice, but it takes minority voice and a significant white voice to back up that kind of book, back up that kind of character, and you just haven't had it yet.
Let me go to a call. We have a quick call. Because we got time. It's like 6 minutes. So let me bring in the caller first. 301, welcome to the comic shop. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Yeah, thanks, Afro Nerd. This is B.A. I'm listening to your show, and I just got a couple of questions.
This is new for you, B.A. Usually you're on the next
yeah,
door.
I just saw you on. I tuned in, I guess, a little early. But it's a very interesting conversation. Let me just first admit that I'm not really into comic books. I'm more into the legal side of it, the intellectual property.
Right,
the marketing, the trademarks, copyrights, and so forth. Who owns that? Do the big houses, Marvel and DC, own most of the black characters in comics?
Yeah, most of them. But like, let's say what Tony Isabella owns, Black Lightning, right, Daryl? More or less.
Yeah. He's got more than a 70% share of it, at least.
Because you're talking about, to answer your question, you're talking about old school versus new school. Years ago, you know, you had these writers of Jewish descent that created these books, and they're fighting, their families are fighting Jack Kirby, who's behind Captain America and all these other characters, Jack Kirby, even Stan Lee, Simon & Schuster, Siegel & Schuster, I'm sorry. These guys, their families are still fighting for ownership because back in the day when they were 18, 19, 20 years old, the companies took advantage of them. The new comic book creator, he knows better. So now some of them are outright owned by Marvel and DC. Some of them are not. Some of them are partially owned if they're newer. But the old school properties that are, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old, mostly Marvel and DC own those intellectual properties.
So it gets to my point here because, you know, even Winnie the Pooh is arguing, you know, their family is arguing with Disney for their rights back. But here's my point here is if you're Marvel or DC, you believe that the pie is limited. And if you begin to push, say, black or minority or women comic book heroes, do you minimize or dilute the power of some of the tried and true white comic book heroes? Meaning, what I'm pointing, there's essentially no competition. It's the game is stacked. I would think that minority comic books should have their own separate trade association, their own separate publishing houses, their own separate outlets to get the movies and the licensing and all those things out. Because if you're all operating under one roof, I mean, it becomes point. You know, why not just push Thor to black kids or Iron Man?
Well, let me tell you something, BA. Unfortunately, you're doing this in 3 minutes before we go to the next show.
Oh, sorry.
We're gonna have to pick this. No, it's okay. It's because it's good radio. We're gonna have to pick this up next week because what you're talking about, you know, it's a complex issue. There are areas where black representation and black ownership exists. On the independent side, they're there. Dwayne McDuffie, essentially one of, you know, our hero, he was doing it. He tried. He had Milestone Comics in the early 90s that made some noise. He was trying to do it, but there are factors out there. I mean, it's a complex issue. And answer your question, there's shadows of that.
Okay,
okay, but where it needs to be.
Here. You know what, BA? Call back next week.
I will.
To get into this more because this is a very interesting. You know, it is Black History Month, so we need to start talking about this more.
Okay, I'll check back in next week, gentlemen. Thank you.
We appreciate
it. Thank you, BA.
Thanks, BA.
All right, we got an early plot point for next week.
Yeah, well, BA is a serious dude. He's an educator out of Maryland, so he knows this stuff. Like you say, he may not be a comic book guy, but he's interested on the intellectual property side, which half this stuff is about intellectual property, Daryl, if you really get into it. So he brings up some serious topics when we're about to leave. So before we do the next show, heck, we didn't even talk about Coonskin. That's a whole different battle right there. Coonskin and Ralph Bakshi and all that stuff, Fritz the Cat. I still want to get into that. And all those racist cartoons from Warner Brothers. We didn't talk about that. So
hey,
we're going to look at next week.
Yeah.
You know?
But next week, Mr. Walker, if you could bring Mr. Love next week too, BA, next week. It's going to be a throwdown, man. I think I'll be able to piss everybody off next week.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know what? It's good to have those guys on because they work for Dark Horse. And what I want to know is, even though they work for Dark Horse, are they contractually, is like a non-compete? Can you work with Dark Horse and still do work for DC? Well, you know what? We'll find out next week. All right, gentlemen. Chad, as always, continue listening. We appreciate the support. A great addition to our show. And we're going next door, Captain, to do our thing. It's been real. Do it again.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
You too.
Spock with a beard?
I think not.
What?
How come you got no brothers up on the wall?
Man, ask Sal, right?
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers up on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only. Take it easy,
huh?
And you, hey, don't stop me today.
What? Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have to say.
You looking for trouble?
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble? Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
You're a real ball breaker. You're always coming in here looking for trouble, huh? Suppose I busted your head. How would you...
Mookie, you want to get your friend out of here?
Well, are you going to kick me out now? Are you going to kick me out, huh? Dearly
beloved, we are gathered here today to enter this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man. What is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funk and lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in the cosmos, where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a locker.
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerve Radio, with your guide, D-Bird, a.k.a. Afro Nerve.
Yes, folks. Yes, yes, yes. Welcome to Afro Nerd featuring Captain Kirk. This is the Grindhouse Edition Part 2, where we bat second with Afro Nerd featuring Captain Kirk. Listen, that was the 1989's Do the Right Thing. That was Giancarlo Esposito, Spike Lee, and Danny Aiello. And you know something? In listening to it, I remember having a different feeling about that film then than I do now politically. Still an excellent work. Perhaps Spike Lee was at the pinnacle of his powers. That, you know, he's hating on Quentin right now, but he couldn't be touched during that period. And I wish he could go back to those days. But you know something, that argument about having black folks on the wall, I don't know if I feel the same way. I might want to open it up briefly after we do a quick groove. I don't know if I feel the same way about that discussion now as I did back then. I don't know. So it's funny how things change, dynamics change, politics change. We'll discuss. Anyway, let's go to a quick groove. One of our premier musicians has left the building, folks. Mr. Donald Byrd, Donald Toussaint L'Ouverture Byrd, died a few days ago at the age of 80. Premier jazz and R&B trumpeter, premier bebop musician. We talk about the influence of James Brown on hip-hop, but you know what? Donald Byrd breakbeats were highly crucial to early hip-hop, late 80s, early 90s hip-hop. Donald Byrd was there, heavily sampled artist. So we'll talk about that in a moment, among other things. Talk about Mr. Byrd. This is Stepping Into Tomorrow. Quick groove. We'll be right back.
Maybe we ought to think twice before we start something nice.
Okay, we're back. Once again, that was Donald Byrd, the late Donald Byrd, who passed on February 4th, 2013. You know, I'll get into it in a moment. Actually, let's just bring in the captain. He's necessary for our endeavors here. Captain, you're needed on the bridge. Let's get to it.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
Can I open it up with talking about Spike Lee and Do the Right Thing? Can I do
sure.
that, sir?
I do want to talk about Donald Byrd, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I'll let you go to that first. Because the music was so beautiful. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to be brief about it. I want to mention Donald Byrd because, first of all, he is in a paragon of jazz funk musicians. And hip-hop, you know, listen, we really didn't see the respect due for James Brown when he passed on, in my estimation, from the hip-hop community. I believe Melly Mel attended his funeral and a few other classic hip-hop artists. They had to be there. Early hip-hop would not be where it is today. Well, I don't want to even say it is today, but as far as its trajectory as being a moneymaker, if it were not for these real musicians that provided the sampling for the early works, Donald Byrd was there. And I come into this because, thank God for the Oracle, the tangential producer of the show, my father, that's the tagline now. And he introduced me at a very early age. I don't even remember not knowing jazz music. I just don't remember. It was always played in the house. I can't say when I was introduced to it was always there. Whether it was Ramsey Lewis, whether it was the Jazz Messengers, Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, you know, heavyweights were played. Jazz rock fusion was very much there. And I feel better for it. I feel better and more knowledgeable for having been introduced to jazz. Of course, the bebop stuff, I went backwards with it. But my first introduction into jazz music was jazz rock fusion. Weather Report, Spyra Gyra, those cats were what I was listening to at a very early age. And then I went back into the Dukes and many of the early artists. Cannonball Adderley was played in the house. So I feel very fortunate to be very much aware of a Donald Byrd. But Donald Byrd, during the late 60s, early 70s, he ruled jazz funk music. And 20 years after that, hip-hop comes along, I should say 10, 15 years after that, and then they co-opt his work and put it into a lot of the late 80s and early 90s hip-hop works. But Mr. Byrd worked with some of the greatest jazz musicians. I mean, he worked with some of the people I mentioned, Coltrane, Rollins, Jackie McLean, Thelonious Monk he worked with. I mean, you're talking about heavyweight people. He had his own group called the Blackbirds, and that's where he came into a lot of this 70s jazz funk. And he was quite an educator. I mean, this gentleman, he taught at my alma mater. He taught at Hampton. He taught at NYU. He taught at Rutgers. He taught at Queens College, Howard University. He maintained two master's degrees from Columbia. He had a law degree and a doctorate from Columbia. So he was a very well-educated man, and it goes hand-in-hand with jazz music. It is what it is. He will be sorely missed, and I will continue to play some more of his work here. And then he definitely fits into the whole notion of urban alternative music, definitely, definitely. We have a caller. Let's open up the lines for a moment. Now the caller left. Caller or callers, the water is warm. 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. Mr. Byrd, again, jazz rock fusionist, rhythm and blues artist. You will be sorely missed, sir. Captain, I know you have some words. Spike Lee.
Just pertaining to Spike Lee. I thought Do the Right Thing at that given time was a great movie. And a lot of people come back at me, and they go back and forth, and they say to me, what do you think about Malcolm X? I said, I thought Malcolm X movie was good. but I thought at the given time you could have gotten any director to do Malcolm X, but you could not get any director to go do the right thing. You just couldn't. You couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. That was Spike Lee. Spike Lee, at his given time, he was just the man at that given time. Now, pertaining to the pictures on the wall, which you had said before, we'll talk about that briefly. At the given time, I felt when I was watching that movie, I felt more or less that those pictures on the wall, this is what you do. This is what you do. This is what I felt like. If you did not like what was on the wall, take your money elsewhere. Just take your money elsewhere. And that's the same way I feel today. You step in some place and you do not like what you see, take your business elsewhere. Nothing more, nothing less. You move on. Same way I felt then, same way I feel now. That's all it was. Black people have a lot of purchasing power. They can take their business anywhere that they feel. If you do not like the way you're treated, take your business elsewhere. That's all. That's all it was. Back over to you, Sir Afflerd.
Yeah, you're kind of going on the same theme I was going on. I remember at the time. Now, remember, part of the reason why I'm going to bring, I think this is Sergio, I'm going to bring him on this as well, because he is the cineast, cinephile, our own. We'll get into him with him being a regular, with his regular regular critique. Mr. Mims.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let me say what I'm going to say about this. I'm going to basically dovetail off of what the captain's talking about. At the time, you're talking about 1989. Yusef Hawkins was killed. There were a number of racial situations. You had Howard Beach going on. A number of renowned racial situations that took place during that period that also provided fire for that film, the racial element of it. And now my politics are a bit different. I think at the time I was riding with Spike Lee in that thought. You have black patronage at an Italian restaurant. Why not have black representation to provide some kind of respect, and I say that in quotes, respect to your patronage? Now, 20-some-odd years later, it's an Italian restaurant. You know, if we were to put a black-themed restaurant, in some other community, I don't know if we would take kindly to someone telling us, "Hey, take your black pictures off the wall. We want to see George Washington on the wall or some other white cultural figure." I don't know if we would take kindly to that. You know, the whole idea is you're coming in to my, you're almost coming into a. I don't know what's the word I'm thinking of. You're almost coming into some kind of, I can't even think of the word, but into an embassy. Like the ginseng start finally kicking in. You're almost coming into someone's embassy. You can't go into a Russian embassy in New York City and tell these Russians what they should do because you're an American now. So now I think a little bit differently about that political conflict. You know, this is an Italian restaurant. We want to do an Italian thing, and you can come and patronize our Italian food. Back then, I didn't think the same way. I think a little differently now. Sergio, what's up?
Well, you hit two things. You hit on a point that I think deals with Spike Lee then and Spike Lee now. It is the fact that times have changed, but he hasn't, and which is why he's in the situation that he's in today. He hasn't changed or developed, you know, with the times. He still wants to be, and he really isn't, and he never really has been, but that was more like an image he created. But he still wants to be the old feisty Spike from Bed-Stuy who said what he thinks. Now, the problem is that, first of all, he doesn't live in Bed-Stuy anymore. He hasn't lived there in a long time. He's much older now. He's in his 50s. He's not the same person, but he wants to pretend that he is, because that's his shtick. And it doesn't play today.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's missed a step. I think he wants to be this radical black person.
Right. He still wants to be the radical guy. And I think that's one reason why his films have suffered in the last decade or so, because tastes have changed, ideas have changed, but he doesn't want to. And a couple years ago, 10 years ago, I said, you know what, I would love to see Spike do a suspense thriller. I would love to see him do just a wacky comedy, just no political message behind it, just do a wacky comedy. How about doing a sci-fi film? Now, I know he is doing a remake of Old Boy. We'll have to see. It's coming up sometime this year. Oh, he has a distributor. Oh, he has a release date, which I can't remember right now. But, this is the kind of stuff maybe he should have been doing earlier. Let's see what happens. But he was still too much, Red Hook Summer, other stuff, the Miracle of St. Anna, which was tone deaf, just tone deaf as a movie.
I didn't really mind that movie. I thought that movie was pretty good, actually.
You're the only one.
I mean, and this is definitely better than what was the movie he did with the lesbianism? What's her name was in it, by the way? Your friend. Oh, wow. From Scandal. What was that name of that film again?
She Hate Me.
Yeah, She Hate Me. That was a stinker. You have to admit,
I know.
That was beyond the pale. I mean, that was horrible.
By the way, I have to say something. You've been talking about Donald Byrd. Somebody else who passed away today, not today, but this week, who was a major influence to me, and his death has not really been covered by the black media, which is sad. It's been covered by the mainstream media. There still are articles being written about him, even today. But the black media has really neglected the fact the death of James DePriest, who was a pioneering symphony conductor, one of the first major black conductors who had to have a truly international career. Even it was more extraordinary because of the fact that back in the early 60s, right at the point when he was about to make his career, he was stricken with polio. And he had to conduct always sitting down. And he used crutches, sometimes a wheelchair. And the fact that here's a black conductor with polio and with his legs paralyzed and established a career is amazing. And I mean an international career. I mean, he conducted all the major orchestras in the world, Cleveland, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was a major conductor overseas, Berlin, Rotterdam, Copenhagen, Budapest. For several years, he conducted in Amsterdam. He was a conductor with the Portland Orchestra. He turned that orchestra around from a regional orchestra to a major national orchestra, recorded many, many albums. You'll love this. You'll love this. A couple years ago, in the late, about 2007, 2008, he was the conductor at the Tokyo Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra, and he was so popular, they created an anime character after him.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I think what I see so far. Well, first of all, listen, he comes from a certain lineage. I'm looking quickly that it says that he was the nephew of Marian Anderson.
Right. He was the nephew of Marian Anderson. That's true.
And he was an incredibly learned man.
He was also a poet. Right.
So, and he was recently given, under the Bush administration, he was given the National Medal of Arts. So, I mean, what you're saying is well, it's the state of the media, isn't it? Even our black media. We don't, we lose our greats. Listen, I know Donald Byrd was an incredibly learned man. You know, at least he's getting some shine. He's getting some shine, but these greats, Sergio, they're not going to be discussed. I mean, we're dropping the ball all the way around. We're dropping the ball all the way around.
If you read the New York Times today, the New York Times today had a long obituary for him. There have been major obituaries in newspapers all over the world for James DePriest. He was a major figure in classical music. He was 76 when he passed away this week. And the black media have totally ignored him, which is, I think, a joke, an embarrassment.
I want to keep you on for a moment. I think we have a friend from our last show coming in. Let me get another caller in. Hold on just 1 second, Serge. 301. I think I know who this is.
Yes. This is Black Achievement. BA.
What's
calling
up?
You,
next door.
Call you back. Yeah. Let me chime in here on Spike Lee for a moment, because I think Spike Lee's legacy today is not his films, okay? It's not necessarily the films. Spike Lee's legacy is one. Let's be honest here, Sergio. In 1985, 86, how many black directors were doing feature films?
There were many directors doing feature films. They were all in the independent movement. Spike Lee was maybe one of the first independent black filmmakers who went Hollywood or was recognized by Hollywood financing. But you had in the 80s, you had Charles Burnett, Larry Clark, Julie Dash, Ben Caldwell, Jamal Fanaka. I can go on and on and on about independent black filmmakers who were making films. They were making feature films before Spike Lee even made his first movie.
Sergio, but beyond all due respect, I didn't say independent. The guy who did Cooley High, Michael Schultz, okay?
Yeah.
He was the only one out there, Sergio. Who was getting budgets from Hollywood to do films. So Spike Lee did open that up for other black directors to come in and get budgets to do Hollywood feature film. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying he wasn't the only black man with a camera directing movies. That's not my point. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying to get Hollywood's attention, to put money, $5, $6, $7 million in the films with black directors, Spike sort of opened that up for some people. And I got to give him the credit.
There are two things here. Just because Hollywood recognizes you doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're a good director.
I agree, Sergio. That's not my point.
Number two, $5, $6, $7 million, even back then, wasn't a hell of a lot of money.
I agree.
You were still being ghettoized as a B movie director.
Sergio, you get no disagreement with me on those issues. I'm not. My only point is $5, $6 million to do for Matty Rich to do Straight Out of Brooklyn, or for John Singleton to do Boys in the Hood is better than no money, no picture at all.
He did that film for $5. That wasn't a $5 million picture. Not Straight Out of Brooklyn.
Okay. Well, let me also just say this one more point, Sergio, and you may disagree with me or agree with me here. But I think Spike opened up the door for a lot of black actors to go to do other bigger and better things, like Sam Jackson, for one. Lawrence Fishburne. Giancarlo Esposito. He put people in film.
Rosie Perez.
That I don't think would have been in. Well, I can't say, but he put people in film and gave them a launch pad to go on and do other things.
Well, you know something else? I mean, listen, we can agree or disagree about it, but I think VA is onto something. That Spike Lee really heralded a black film movement from the late 80s to the early, to let's say the mid 90s, where people were focusing on a certain level of diversity in black films that we have not seen now. Matter of fact, I was thinking about this a few days ago, and then we're going to have to move along because we're actually going into, we changed the show completely around, but I was thinking about, you know, early 70s television. When you in Shadow and Axe, I wanted to talk about this on the comic shop, and we failed to get into that as well, with Ralph Bakshi, who I want to get on the show, with his coonskin and all that stuff. There's a lot more experimentation in the 70s. So 60s and 70s, where we can't even see this type of stuff anymore. In the 90s, you had more diversity in black film than what we have now. We at least had, I mean, we don't even see a fully black major television TV shows anymore. You had a Jefferson, you remember we had Jeffersons and Good Times and Sanford and Son, whatever you think about them. They were on major networks. Something happened where now we don't have fully black casted TV shows on network. That just completely disappeared. I think Cosby might have been the last show on real network TV. Now we're relegated to a segregated thing. I don't even know why that's even allowed. So
okay, no, here's the thing. The reason it happened, which people don't want to talk about, is that things have changed so radically in television nowadays. Back then, before cable, before, you know, the internet, before video games, before, you know, streaming, you know, you had three major networks, yeah, and then PBS. You had that. You could put anything on those networks and they would get an audience because there was nothing else left. I mean, there was no other alternative. That's what I mean to say. There was no other alternative. Now everything is fractured. Everything is fractured. You have all these cable channels competing, attracting a certain segment of the audience. As a result, the major networks, they don't know what to do because they're getting maybe half of the number audience they got a decade ago,
not even half. More
right?
Like a third.
Maybe a third, right? So right now, they just want to get an audience, and what's getting an audience are reality shows. Anything that will get a big audience, they can't put a black show on the air simply because the audience that will come for a show will be small compared to what they've got. A black show will work on syndication. It'll work on cable. But that audience is too small for networks nowadays. Now, you know what's the big hit show right now on TV? A Scandal. With Kerry Washington. That show
right.
is huge. That show has been a huge hit for ABC. Now, will they do other shows with, a black female lead or, you know, a black male lead? I don't know. There's talk about doing, I don't know why, there's talk about doing a reboot of Ironside. I wrote about
this on Shadow and Axe.
Blair Underwood. You know, instead of pushing the guy, he's the one who's being pushed, as I said. But the thing has changed. It has changed so radically. You know, networks are desperate for an audience, any kind of audience. So they're going to go for the broadest, they're going to go for the show that can get the biggest audience they can get. They can't afford nowadays to just get a sliver of an audience, you know, because back then, 20 years ago, you could get a sliver of an audience and you still would get 10 million viewers.
All right,
you can't do that anymore.
Gentlemen, I want to hold everyone on. We're going to make this, we only got about 20-something minutes left, so I want to hold everyone on. I want to go to another Bird Groove, and when I come back, I want to change things around a little bit. I'd like for you guys to hang on if you may. Quickly, since we're on TV, I want to talk about Christopher Dorner rampaging, this L.A. cop thing. Well, let's get to that in a moment. Before him, I left a cliffhanger on the last show with Roots versus Django, since we're on this TV thing. And it's interesting with the cast of Roots. They were interviewed on Joe Madison's show on Sirius XM. I have a clip of that. I want to play this clip as to what they felt, what they really felt about Quentin Tarantino. It was pretty interesting. So I want to mix that up a little bit, and then we'll talk about
Christopher Dorner doing his Django thing. I think that's what it is. I think he might have been inspired by Django, gentlemen. Anyway, let's go to another Donald Byrd groove, and then we'll be back in a moment. This is Flight Time. Flight Time by the late Donald Byrd. Let's groove. Okay, folks, that's my own version of editing there. That was, again, Donald Byrd, and that was Flight Time. As an anecdote, actually, you know, of course, I play them quite a bit because they are proteges of Prince. The Time derived their name from Flight Time, which was that single I just played. Flight Time was the original group of The Time, and then they changed it to The Time. So just a little bit of a connective tissue there that they were inspired by Donald Byrd from that song Flight Time. All right, we're back into the vault again. This is Afternoon featuring Captain Kirk. We have the gang all here, B.A. and, of course, Sergio Mims and the captain. We were talking about initially about everything under the sun as far as Spike Lee. But I want to move things along a little bit. There was a little bit of controversy because of Quentin Tarantino's latest work, Django, which I actually love Django, and I know Sergio does too. I can't stop thinking about this movie. I think half the country can't stop talking about Django. Now I'm hearing other DJs on terrestrial radio referring to themselves as Django. Who knows if Christopher Dorner, he talked about Inglourious Basterds, and he did shout out Quentin Tarantino. So I don't know, in his manifesto, gentlemen, I don't know if he is the embodiment of Django. I don't know. I'm not going to say that yet. But anyway, Joe Madison on Sirius XM had the cast
of Roots, 1977, the ABC miniseries that was, I think, to this date, is the most watched miniseries in television history. Talk about numbers, Sergio. The amount of people that looked at that miniseries, it's still mind-boggling that many people were glued to their TV sets 36 years ago. Anyway, now because of Django Unchained's success, Madison asked them the obvious question, what are your thoughts on Roots? On Django, the cast of Roots. So if I can find this clip, I was a little bit surprised about their feelings toward Django. They didn't like it too much. They thought that Quentin Tarantino's remarks about their work was a bit dismissive. And they might have a point there. They might have a point. So I can find this clip. Wait a minute. Where is this thing? So many clips. Not going to look through all this stuff. While I'm looking for this clip, gentlemen, what are your thoughts about this Django versus Roots discussion? Is it fair?
First of all, they also made similar negative comments about Django on Wendy Williams' show. So they're probably going to say the same thing. Here's a couple of things you got to keep in mind. Yeah, I can understand why they're angry because, of course, they were involved in Roots, and you're right. It was and still is one of the most watched shows in television history. And also, don't forget, it came in the middle of one of the worst winters of that year. Everybody was at home. Nobody was going out. The other thing, too, is that a lot of people don't know this. ABC was so convinced that show was going to flop that they made it a miniseries that ran 1 week. It was supposed to be every week, once a week. But they were so convinced nobody was going to watch the show, they scheduled it for 1 week. You know. The other thing is that they don't mention, and people forget, when Roots came out, it was attacked by a lot of black scholars as being woefully inaccurate in terms of slavery. Woefully inaccurate. I still remember some of those articles. I mean, many black scholars and historians tore Roots apart, saying that this was not how slavery was. The show is really very much, someone who compared it to a Horatio Alger story. You know, it was overly romantic at times. Also, it has, I thought, one of the worst endings ever. If you remember how it ended, the big climax at the end, does anybody remember?
It's been so long, sir.
They went off into the sunset?
No. Well, that's true. But what happens is that this character, it was played by George Sanford Brown. Now I can't remember the name of his character. He finally gets this white guy tied up to a tree.
And he's going to whip him. Yeah,
he's
going to
whip
that.
Him. Right.
Didn't Kizzy spit in the water or something at the end?
I can't remember.
There was a part where an older Kizzy spit in her master's water.
Shelley Winter's character, yeah.
Right, but this white guy is strapped to a tree, and this black guy has the opportunity to whip him, and he doesn't. He drops the whip to the ground and says, you know, I can't come down to your level. I won't do it. And I remember seeing that when it was on TV, and I said, this is BS. I don't care. You know, I want to see him whip the white man.
Stay on that note. I got the clip. Let's go to the Roots, the cast themselves. Let them speak, and then we'll unpack. All right, folks, this is Joe Madison with the cast of Roots. Hold on.
I want to say, being an immigrant to this country, the Roots movie taught me and my family a lot.
Where are you from?
I was born in England.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And it not only taught us a lot, it also helped me understand why people treated me differently when I went to public school, so it increased my tolerance for that kind of behavior.
Mm.
So my question to you is, considering the movies and everything being developed today, do you feel that the filmmakers, the writers, actors, actresses are focusing more on pleasing the masses as opposed to creating quality classics?
Can I piggyback on your question?
Sure.
Which leads me to the one question I wanted to ask. Roots Django.
Mm. Oh, boy.
You had to go there.
It fits. It piggybacks with her question.
It does.
It piggybacks with her question. I'll let you. I'll let all of the four of you take it wherever you want to take it.
You want to start, Ben?
Well, I didn't see the movie.
Which you didn't see Django.
I have not seen. But let me just say one thing. Let me just say one thing, Ben.
Yes.
Mr. Tarantino has made me angry with his interview with, I believe it was Ebony Magazine, mm-hmm. trying to make us small. We were the thing that opened up the doors to America, seeing what our history was all about. That's not a small thing. That's not a weak story. And it's our story. A black man wrote this story about our experiences. And I respect Tarantino's talent, but he still is a white man trying to tell a black story. That's all I got to say.
Quentin has gone on record as saying that the portrayals and the characters and their portrayals and roots were unrealistic in his view.
Well, I think he's a clever devil.
And
I think it's...
But there's a lot of disagreement in my heart about whether that is true.
But I think he's a clever devil.
A lot of disagreement in my heart.
I think he's a clever devil. I think he knows how to get headlines.
Yeah.
So he knows on his other things in Kill Bill, he gets attention. He smashes myths. That's his claim to fame.
He's also very good at revisionist history. I mean,
oh, he's great. He's a clever
the
I don't want to give him that kind of airtime because he's not coming from a place of
knowledge. It's not history. It's something else.
The more we talk about it, the more it stays. Like, the more you complain, the more you remain. So the more we talk about Tarantino and his misfortune, and that's his side of the street. He's a brilliant filmmaker.
Very clever businessman.
He's done some wonderful entertainment. But there's no comparison.
He's put a lot of black people to work.
Family.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly.
We appreciate the
exactly.
work.
We appreciate
but we're talking about a miniseries that went on for 7 days compared to a movie that's 2 hours
right.
or something.
Right.
He's not coming from a frame of reference.
So it goes back to her question. Are filmmakers and actors focus more on pleasing the masses than creating classics? Roots is a classic.
We don't engage in storytelling in the popular culture so much anymore. You know, the novelization of television from which the miniseries sprang was an art form that you know was created in the 70s and 80s. We are addicted in this culture now to reality television, and it's not so much storytelling as voyeurism.
Yes.
And there's a big difference.
Very good.
There's a big difference.
Very good.
Cut this off.
We only have, about 2 minutes left.
Cut it off.
I want to...
All right, listen. Let me say something real quick on this. And I think I know where Sergio's going to go with this.
Oh, yeah. You know where I'm going with this. Go ahead.
Okay,
bad.
Listen. This is going to be painful. This is going to be painful, right? Because I loved Roots when it came out. And I still respect it as far as what it was, but we have to be honest. And this goes to Spike Lee in some way, too. Just as Spike Lee threw shade on Quentin Tarantino, we forget that Spike Lee, there was arguments about him when he did Malcolm X, that he was trying to corporatize Malcolm X's image. Yet I was the person that wore a Malcolm X hat. I wore the X hat at that time also, like everybody else. Half of Queens and Brooklyn were wearing those X hats. Trust me. And the same argument that he talked about with Quentin Tarantino trying to corporatize or commodify slavery, he did the same thing himself and was critiqued for it for Malcolm X. Now we turn around with Roots. The argument can be made that Roots was revisionist history, equally as revisionist and as fantastic as Quentin Tarantino's obviously fantastic Django Unchained. We know no one wants to talk about this because black folks need Roots to be real. Let's keep it real. Let's keep it real. Black folks need Roots to be real. But what really goes down on this, and I loved Alex Haley. But Alex Haley was sued for quite a bit of money for plagiarism because his book followed a book called The African. It was a book called The African that was written by an author by the name of Harold Carlander. Harold Carlander wrote The African, and The African was almost entirely Roots. No one wants to talk about that. No one wants to talk about that. But if we're going to be honest, Sergio Imprint, at the time that Roots was out, there was quite a few historians that came out against Roots. And then if you double up on that, the author was sued and lost for plagiarism.
No. Let me go back.
Wait, let me.
No. I'm sorry. This is what they said was BS. First of all, they're attacking Quentin Tarantino, a white guy, for making Django Unchained. Who made Roots? It was produced by a white man, David Roper, one of the biggest white TV producers in the period. It was directed mainly by white directors. I think there was one black director for one episode. It was edited by white people. It was on ABC, a white network. I mean, that show was created by white people. And they're going to turn around and pretend it was an all-black thing? I don't think so. There are black people who really think, and I know, who believe that Roots was an all-black show. No, it wasn't. It was all white people behind the camera.
Right.
You know,
yeah, exactly. You know, so they're going to turn around and criticize, well, you know, you're blacker than me. Oh, please. And as you mentioned, right, the fact that this show, Roots, was constantly heavily criticized by black historians, black scholars, as being woefully inaccurate about slavery. Even then, even when I saw the show, when it came out, you want to do a film about slavery, then you want to see a movie about slavery, then see Sankofa, Halle Jarima's movie. You know? Let's see 12 Years a Slave that was directed by Steve McQueen that's coming out later this year. You know, but, you know, don't give me a show produced by ABC that was made to be entertainment, not a history lesson. It was made as entertainment, first and foremost.
We have a caller real quick. I want to get to the caller. But we have to, you know, critique and then pull back. Roots has to be looked at for what it was and what it inspired. I mean, the fact that we have Ancestry.com, that you can take DNA tests that can at least get you close to your lineage in Africa, which is, you know, it's an impossibility. It inspired folks to look into their lineage. So you have to give credit for what it is due. It's just painful that all this stuff behind the scenes kind of put knocks down the house of cards with
D-Bird, let me get this out. Let me say this, D-Bird, 15 seconds. Let me say this, D-Bird. To me, the travesty is, in between Roots and Django, you got about 26, 27 years.
Yep.
And there's nothing else to make the comparison to Roots or to Django, meaning in terms of what has been on network television with respect to slavery or what has been in the mainstream theaters with respect to slavery. Why are we comparing Roots to Django?
Whose fault is that? Whose fault is that? Is our fault? I mean, I would say it's our fault, right?
Yes,
because
I agree.
I'll give you an example. There are 7 movies, independently made films, that are dealing with slavery this year, which are being produced this year. 7 movies. Of those 7 films, one is directed by an African American. 2 are directed by black British directors. The others are directed by white directors, right? Now, if you're going to sit around and wait for white people to make a movie about slavery, black people, African Americans are not making films about slavery because we're too psychologically damaged by it. We still can't deal with it.
Well, hold on. We have to go to the caller.
Nah.
We have to go to the caller, but we have to say this, Sergio. There's always Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's go to him. All right. He probably has some transsexuals as a slave. That'd be his version of it. Anyway, let's go to this caller. Caller, welcome to AfroNerd. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hello, good evening. How you doing? This is Mike from Chicago.
What's up?
I'm just calling. I've been kind of popping around the internet there and listening to the program, and I just want to say this has been riveting stuff, and really has changed my perspective on a couple of things, and just going to look into some of the stuff I've heard you guys been talking about a little bit more deeply. I had kind of a question. You guys seem to all, this panel knows a lot of things. And
I just sort of had a question touching on what you gentlemen were talking about. Frank Ocean and Billy Ocean, are they related? Because I don't know a lot of colored fellas that I can ask this question to.
Let me say this
about the psychological effects of slavery. Okay,
you know what? I heard this guy's vernacular.
Okay.
About a bean, buddy, bah, but a bean.
Yep.
And I was
nice.
At that point, I stuck with him because I thought, okay, I'm going to dismiss his faux accent, but. You know what? Be that as it may, we need comedy.
All right, let's keep going. Let's keep going. Go ahead.
Right.
Let me say this. I can think of one movie, Beloved, which was written by Toni Morrison, purchased and produced by Oprah Winfrey. Nobody talks about Beloved comparing it to Roots. Okay.
Yeah. Who directed the movie?
Well, you know who directed the movie. You know, the white gentleman who directed.
Jonathan Demme.
Hey, that Oprah selected him. She was the executive producer. You know what do you?
How did that film do at the box office?
That's
I couldn't watch 5 minutes of it, so I don't
exactly.
know
why. That's why there's no comparison.
You know, I could. There's no. But here's my point. I want to make with Sergio. Okay, with Roots and I believe, was that Leslie Uggams who was commenting there? Was that Leslie Uggams?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here's my point with Roots.
Here's my point with Roots. And Django. Okay, first of all, Joe Madison, that's like apples and oranges. Not even apples and oranges. It's like apples and rocks. Okay, you got two different genres of film. Like you said, one is for television. Television is there to sell liquid detergent and soda drink. Okay, that's why things appear on TV. You're there on TV to sell goods. Okay. A feature film is something totally different. And this was essentially a fantasy feature film wrapped around a spaghetti western rolled up in slavery, okay? Those two things, that there are no comparisons. It's just no – and that's why I said the travesty is we really don't have a comparison with Roots. It was Roots and shut it down. There's nothing else to follow behind it since 77. Nothing. And
yeah,
I agree.
Amistad came out there also, right? I mean, that was another, you know, kind of a milquetoast kind of thing.
And who directed that, Sergio?
Spielberg.
Well, Spielberg did it.
Right.
Spielberg.
And you know, and
right.
you know what? Let me tell you something. You know how Django got started is because the concept of Django got started is because producer Reginald Hudlin, who I know, and Quentin Tarantino are friends. And 10 years ago, they were having a discussion about slavery in movies. And they were talking about Amistad. And both of them hated Amistad.
Right.
And Tarantino asked Reggie, have you ever seen a film about slavery that you like, that you think is good? And Reggie said, yeah, The Legend of Nigger Charlie with Fred Williamson.
Okay.
And he said, that film, you got to check that film out. Because that it really is, in many ways, proto-Django. And that started the whole thing ball rolling, right? You know, but the thing about it is that I stand by what I say. I believe, and I've had many conversations with people about this, not just about Django, but about other things as well, that African-Americans, we have still psychological problems. Barriers with slavery. It's still too painful. The psychological, you know, chains, mind chains are still with us, right? Now, you can disagree with me. I think it's true. I think it's absolutely true, and I think that's one of the main reasons why there haven't been more films about slavery made by black directors. By African-American directors. The British black directors don't have a problem. Of course, white directors don't have a problem. But African-American directors, I think, there's a psychological barrier about making a film such as that.
We got about 2 minutes remaining, unfortunately. We're going to have to table this again, B.A., for next week. I think we're going to have a festive show next week. Actually, we might be able to do this on Wednesday, some of it. But... in closing, all I can really say, really, gentlemen, is that whatever someone may think about Django inspired more talk about slavery.
whatever. I mean, I haven't seen so many articles on the boob tube or on the internet that have actually got into the more historical scholarship since Django. So we know that Django is a fantasy. I thought, to me, it was a love letter to black people on the part, to me.
No, but no. Here's the thing. I wish more films were like that. Now, and
that's
it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me if you like the film or you hate the film. That's okay, as long as you see it. And, you know, I don't care. But I would love. There used to be a lot of films like that back in the 70s, back in the 60s, back in some of the part of the 80s. There were films that people would go see, and they would have a visceral reaction to. Either they liked it or they loved it or they hated it or whatever. It doesn't matter, right? And I wish more films could do that nowadays. Nowadays, you go see a film, you're like, yeah, it's okay. It's all right.
Well, let me end it with this. I can go to any bookshelf, any bookstore, and get a plethora of books on the Holocaust written by Jews. I can go to the movie theater and as well as miniseries and see miniseries produced, directed, starring Jewish actors, and there's no problem. There's no psychological effect, no issue. They tell it all, butt naked, raw truth. I don't know why it comes to African Americans, who don't know anything about slavery. Okay, we got so somehow recoil at the notion of doing a little movie on slavery.
Where are they? I'm not talking about forget Hollywood.
We're running out of time, gentlemen.
Forget Hollywood. Don't talk about Hollywood making all these films about slavery. I'm just talking about most black filmmakers are independent filmmakers anyway. So they're outside of the Hollywood mainstream. Most of them are. So how come there haven't been more independently made films by black directors about slavery? As I said, you got 7 independently made films dealing with slavery coming out this year. Only one is directed by an African-American director. What's the reason for that?
Well, you know what? We'll table this for Wednesday.
Thank you. Did I cause this? All I said was that it was a great movie about Spike Lee. And look what happened.
All right. Listen, we'll table it for Wednesday. As always, gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. As ever, I should say. I got to change that. As ever, it's been an
Thank
absolute
you.
Pleasure. And we'll do it again on Wednesday. This is Pendulum.
Please.
We're gonna this is Pendulum Tarantula, a little bit of reggae stock. Wednesday, gentlemen. It's been real.
All right.